This time of year, you're going to find me jigging for crappies off my father-in-law's boat, celebrating a successful turkey hunt, or just sitting on the back deck watching time go by with a quality cigar from Thompson Cigar. Thompson Cigar has been around since 1915, offering the widest array of cigars and cigar accessories at very affordable prices. Thompson Cigar offers your favorite brands like Swisher Sweets, Cohiba, Backwoods, and Monte Cristo shipped fresh directly to your door. Also, be sure to check out their 5-pack fever deals and join their value club for big savings. Visit thompsoncigar.com and enter the discount code SE at checkout for 20% off of all orders over $75. Thompson Cigar, quality cigars at affordable prices. You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable. This episode of the Sportsman's Empire is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. Since 1952, Interstate Batteries has been evoking compassion and a trustworthy spirit into the surrounding communities. Interstate Batteries is a mission-driven company fueled by purpose and guided by their values. If you need help locating a specific battery, stop into your local Interstate Batteries retail store and speak with a battery specialist. They even offer cell phone repairs. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
This President's Day, upgrade the look of your home without breaking your budget. Save up to 50% site-wide on new window treatments at Blinds.com. Blinds.com makes it easy with free virtual consultations on your schedule and samples delivered to your door fast and free. With over 25 million windows covered and a 100% satisfaction guarantee, you can count on Blinds.com to deliver results you'll love.
Shop up to 50% off site-wide plus a free professional measure during the President's Day Mega Sale. Last chance happening right now at Blinds.com. Terms apply.
Welcome to Maximize Your Hunt, the podcast dedicated to those who want the most out of their hunting property. This podcast explores land management, habitat improvement, and hunting strategies that will help you maximize your time in the field. Follow along as industry professionals that live and breathe white-tailed deer share their secrets to success. And now, the founder of Whitetail Landscapes, your host, John Teeter.
Welcome back to part two. In this podcast, John Kemp and I from AEA get into more details on soil health, photosynthesis. We talk about food layout and architecture, as well as use of corn. I get into some examples of my concern with corn. He details some of his ideology around certain plants and a process to make corn more efficient on your landscape. We look at a peer-reviewed article that was done by some of the leaders in the industry and break it down, diagnose some of the things we agree with and don't agree with, and really provide a whole bunch of more information that I think is super helpful for you all thinking about your landscape, food plots, you know, design, etc. So thanks for listening, and here's more from John and I. I was asked a question not too long ago, and I'm certainly not an expert in your field, and I'll admit that. But maximizing photosynthesis and understanding how you can do that in a scale where, you know, maybe this is a small particular property, could be in a garden for that matter, increasing the amount of sugar that goes into the soil that feeds the microbes, where does that really start? And in your mind, we've kind of hit on this a little bit, but where does that actually start? Does it start with the plants that you're using, the inoculation, the trace minerals? What is the starting point for most people?
Yes, all of those things. the starting point is the photosynthesis engine in the leaf. When you think about it from a very foundational first principles perspective, photosynthesis is the only pathway we have of bringing new energy into an ecosystem. Everything else is just recycling. Photosynthesis is the pathway of bringing new energy into an ecosystem. And so you want to optimize photosynthesis within that leaf. And you mentioned a bit ago that you've been using foliar applications. I've been a big champion of foliar applications for a long time, because when foliar applications are well designed, they can increase the quantity of sugar that is produced in every square inch of leaf surface area by a factor of 3 to 4x in every 24-hour photo period. That's significant. When you do the math, and I've walked through this exercise with a lot of farmers, when you do the math of if you increase the sugar production by 3x on a given crop, and you do the math of how much sugar and how much carbon that puts into the soil, how much organic matter you build, you cannot economically afford to compete with that by any other means. You cannot afford to put on enough compost or to put on enough manure or to put on enough carbon of any sort to compete with the amount of sugar that plants can import into the soil, the amount of carbon that they can import as contained within that sugar. And so most plants are not photosynthesizing. What is common today is most plants photosynthesizing somewhere in the neighborhood of about 10 to 20% of their genetic capability, of their inherent photosynthetic capacity, because of nutrient resource bottlenecks. I'll give you one example. Most plants today, this is universally across many ecosystems, but many plants today are very commonly deficient of manganese for a whole bunch of ecosystem reasons related to acid rainfall and other driving factors. But without getting into those, let's just say that on our sap analysis results or forage analysis results, unless a grower is deliberately addressing manganese, we see manganese deficiencies showing up in over 90% of the samples that we pull. The only exceptions are areas with volcanic soils, like around Mount St. Helens and in Hawaii and so forth.
Sure.
And this is fundamental to a plant because as the plant is photosynthesizing, it's working with two, or you could say perhaps three raw materials. It's working with water, carbon dioxide, and sunlight. And the first step for water is that as the water is absorbed into the plant, that water molecule of H2O gets split in a process called water hydrolysis. It gets split into hydrogen and hydroxyl, H and OH. And that process is completely dependent on an enzyme that is dependent on manganese. So it doesn't matter if you have a plant in perfect growing conditions. It has the perfect amount of water, the perfect amount of carbon dioxide, the perfect amount of sunlight. If that plant is deficient in manganese, manganese becomes the bottleneck that limits photosynthesis and can throttle it down to as little as 10 to 15% of what that plant is actually capable of. That is an extremely common scenario. It's so common. It is the prevailing scenario in most ecosystem contexts.
Let's talk about air for a second. Nicole Masters, a lot of people that are, you know, in this field that promote certain aspects of soil health, there's a lot of focus around air. Air in the soil, air exchange. So I want you to, we're dealing with, you know, degraded soils, depending on, you know, how they've been managed. You mentioned acid rain, all the leaching effects that have happened over the years. I've always tried to be gentle with my soils, and I've used moldboard plows for sod removal, inverting the soil. I've thought about that for eons if that was sensible. I've done throw and grow for 10 years where I'm just crimping a crop at some state, usually near the end of the vegetative state, and throwing seed on the ground like Johnny Appleseed, adding foliars, creating my own composts, being very simplistic. This in-touchness that you're talking about and being very considerate of every aspect of your soil without mechanically manhandling it, and this is the issue that I'm going to get into. I'm buying a new property right now. The soil is extremely compacted. Mechanically, I'm going to go in, I'm going to subsoil the soil and start to treat all the deficiencies. And that's going to be my process to start the balancing process, looking at every aspect of it. And then taking some time, seeing how it responds, observing. But mechanically, I want to be soft. And I don't know if you can relate to this or not, but you know, when you're dealing with larger swaths of soil, a lot of times the traditional route is going to some type of vertical tillage, or again, I mentioned moldboard plowing. cultivating in some shape, way, or manner. When you're dealing with hardpans, what do you typically do in your scenario on your site? And I think it's probably soil contextual contingent, but I just want you to talk about that briefly because that's a problem that a lot of people run into.
Yeah, I have a very non-dogmatic perspective. I'm not attached to a certain dogma of such as no-till, it shouldn't be tilled, or that.
Yep.
We should never. I prefer to take a very practical perspective and approach to say what fits this particular context, this soil type, this ecosystem, etc. So when we are dealing with compaction issues, depending on the degree of the type of compaction, there are some types of compaction that can be alleviated with plant roots. But in general, as humans, we tend to be short on patience and we desire to get results quickly. And generally, when there are soil compaction issues to deal with, my most common recommendation for most contexts is to go ahead and solve that compaction issue with machinery, with steel, and then to make sure that you set up a plant and root system architecture so that that does not recreate and you don't need to do it again. I think that's the critical piece that is so often missed is if you deep rip a soil or you aerate it in some way, I'm not of the persuasion that that's going to destroy a soil structure that you're never going to recover. I don't buy that. I've seen too much evidence to the contrary.
I agree.
But then you need to immediately replant that with plants who have robust root systems and have the capacity to create soil structure down deep and good aggregate stability and good aggregate structure down at a significant depth so that compaction zone never reforms. And the good news for you in the food plot setting, unlike a lot of agriculture, is at least as I'm envisioning it or imagining it, is that you don't have repeat exposure to heavy equipment, to combines and tractors and grain carts and everything else. So it should be easy for you to prevent reforming that compaction zone.
Yeah, I think most people are have that awareness, certainly on this podcast. Yes, I would say that's true. I want to go down another road. I remember listening, and I don't remember if this is a YouTube that you did or was on a podcast. You talked about corn production. There's a lot of, I'll say, legume and grain interest around forages for animals, and specifically white-tailed deer. Corn is an influential crop. We try to stay away from corn, but a lot of people like to use corn. And I'm not talking about baiting. I'm talking about growing.
Why do people want to stay away from corn?
I think some of it is the philosophy surrounding the volume and maintenance. So there's a maintenance side of it. There's weed control. There's the nutrient uptake that folks are worried about. But there's an example that I heard you talk about where there was a grower. Now, I've grown corn without any inputs at all. Zero. And it was just part of my crop rotation. I'm not worried about anything related to nutrient uptake, but I know folks are worried about production, specifically voluminous yield for interest. So the question I have to you is, there was I think it had to be a podcast, where you're talking about an environment where there was a corn grower that didn't apply any fertilizer. I don't know if they did it every year. I don't know what setting. I think it was a dryland setting, no irrigation. And then it had amazing results, 150, 200, I don't know if it was 200 bushel of corn an acre. They had success. And some of it had to do with the gene expression and the related, I believe, seed
yep.
relationship with the soil. It was actually producing its own nitrogen.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about. This was dryland corn production in Kansas where they were doing 200 plus bushel per acre corn production for multiple years in a row with no inputs. And when I say no inputs, there was no cover crops, no compost, no nothing. But, you know, let's back up a bit and talk about corn. I actually think corn would be an incredibly valuable crop from a food plot perspective. But we need to think about it differently, radically differently. Let's not pretend that we're growing a field of corn at 30-inch row centers. So if we are growing corn for peak attractiveness and ease of management, here's the way that I would approach it. I would have an established permanent or semi-permanent cover crop of some type. And we probably need to be a bit thoughtful about what species we're growing in there. And then in springtime, I would, just before planting, I would mow that cover crop to the ground in strips. Let's say you do a mower deck of a 4 foot wide strip or something like that.
Sure.
And in that strip, you plant two or three, let's say two rows of corn that are 7 or 10 inches apart that are extremely high population. And you specifically select a corn variety that is particularly attractive to deer. So so you pick a variety that is maybe a high oil content corn, like some of Charlie Brown's genetics up in Wisconsin. So you have this very concentrated band with a high population of corn, and then you skip, let's say 6 feet, 4 to 6 feet, and you plant another row. So instead of planting corn in 30-inch rows, you plant an equivalent population, a very high population density in specific bands. What that does is it gives the corn if you mow that cover crop to the ground and you temporarily stunt it in the row, it gives that corn a chance to get established in that row. And we know corn responds to this edge effect. The outside row or two of a field will produce 2 to 3x what corn plants will further inside the field that are getting more shade. And when you plant these high population densities, there's fascinating work being done by Jason Malk in Indiana and the Stock Cropper out in Iowa, where they're doing these strip row corns where they're doing 60-inch or 90-inch rows. And they're getting equivalent yields on 90-inch rows as they are on 30-inch rows with high population density. But the 90-inch row gives them enough sunlight down in between the corn rows where they're able to continue growing a cover crop. So we need to start thinking about corn plant differently. Plant it in strips, plant it in rows, high population density in that row with varieties that are particularly attractive to corn or that are particularly attractive to deer. Now, is it going to look like a nice, pretty field of corn? No, it's not. Will it be effective as a food plot? Absolutely, it will be. And the other thing that it will be is it'll be effective at regenerating soil. Corn is more efficient than almost any other plant at putting large amounts of carbon and sugars into the soil. It's a very valuable addition to a crop system.
Yeah, I think being a C4 plant, I think that's incredible. It's a smart thing to do. The strip idea and concept that we've been employing with clients, again, it's this process around just maybe it's the gap of getting through the I need to add inputs to it. I mean, you know, on my own particular property, for example, we do strip food plots. So same concept where you have a perennial and annual. And on the annual basis, which could be corn for that example, having that understory development of some type of cover crop, just again, you go into the winter months, you don't want to have denuded or open soil. So again, worried about erosion, it's all contextual, depends on field layout, et cetera. I really like this idea, and I think it works really well to the flow and movement of deer across the landscape. I think we just get stuck in the mantra that, you know, the plants require additional inputs. And what you're saying, at least what we said originally, was once we create this base, and again, there's going to be some plants that, or excuse me, some micro or macro nutrients that may need replacement over time, you know, based on the consumption cycle. But again, we're not focused on taking yield. We're not taking 100% of the crop off the plant of the field. You know, some of it's being ingested and digested by animals. Hopefully they're leaving some behind in fecal matter, but you know, we're not losing the mass majority of the crop. So I think it's really important to think about that in context. And to your point earlier, based on my crop rotation, I got wonderful yields out of the corn, and I didn't apply any foliars or anything. I mean, it was just part of my rotation. Now I got a question for you. It just brings up another thought to me. So in some of my concepts and layouts I'm doing with clients, I'm doing, these strips, and, you know, one strip will be a perennial, one will be an annual. And in some of those perennial strips, generally speaking, it could be a combination of something that's a legume, a forb that's a non-legume, and then other plants in there. Sometimes I'll actually have grasses in those. And sometimes I think I've introduced, I think, flax, phacelia, some non-edibles for deer. They're not edible for deer, but they're in that complex of plants. And then I keep those in a rotation for 3 to 4 years, sometimes longer. And these will be adjacent maybe to some perennial crops. They could be fruit trees. They also could be woody material or crops for other purposes. In some examples, I've got these, you know, deep-rooted switchgrass plantings, again, creating, and I'm hoping, some fungal connection amongst different varieties in kind of these, I'll just say, in concert with each other. So you have a cover source, a food source that's low, a food source that's high. We call that canvassing when we're looking at the different layouts. And again, it creates this like ultimate attraction of food cover, and it creates flow and movement across the food plot. Where I run into trouble a lot of times is getting on these field, harvesting crops, you know, rotating crops, those type of things. And I think a lot of people that are doing this, they're not mindful of compaction timing. When I'm doing, like, for example, my own property here, when I'm rotating, I crimp some of the oats or the wheat. The timing of that's critical in throwing down seed. I think what I'm getting at is, I think a lot of this has to do with understanding maturity rates of plants. We talked a little bit about root architecture, balancing the soil, but in context, I don't believe a large swath of corn, you know, in my scenario will be because of the size of area and obviously edibility, deer will have a high interest and wipe those things out. So I think in context, we need to think about scale. And I think a lot of times we don't think about the volume of consumption of these plants when you have low food preference areas interior to your, you know, your properties. We're trying to create the right amount of traction in some of these areas and balancing the entire landscape. So I think what I was getting at was there is definitely a connection between the plants that I'm, you know, promoting in the landscape that are edibles and not edibles, and creating some fungal connections, hopefully, versus those long-term and short-term plants. And it's thinking about that a little bit more in a community than just, hey, we're putting corn on the landscape. So probably one of the reasons I say stay away from corn, because it's just, it is a solution and it's very viable and deer attracted to it, but there's other aspects of design to consider. So I guess I just went on a rant.
Well, I think, based on what I've observed on many different farms, as you can imagine with the experience, I shared the experience that we had on my uncle's farm on Michigan.
Yeah.
In Michigan. We've had that experience with a broad array of different crops and different ecosystems and contexts where when you improve plant health and quality, they become very attractive to deer, and you can pull in deer for, I think, a lot farther than people realize. I think it's measured in miles, more than 1 mile.
Yeah.
And so you can, when you think about plant attractiveness, there is a genetics component. Some corn varieties are more attractive than others. Some bean varieties are more attractive than others. Forage varieties are more attractive than others. We all know that piece to be true. But I think it's been just my observation at a distance. I don't have intimate familiarity with what is happening in the deer food plot space, but my observation at a distance is that most people, for most people, the conversation then largely stops with genetic selection. And what many people don't realize is that I could take a variety that doesn't have the same degree of attractiveness, and I can manage the attrition to outperform the attractiveness of a variety that genetically has genetics for very good attractiveness. So a different way of saying that is to say that good nutrition can supersede bad genetics, or vice versa, poor nutrition can supersede good genetics.
Okay. Let's get to the last piece of this. So I got you for a little bit longer. And I want to take advantage of your time. Soil quality does not predict plant nutrition available to white-tailed deer. This is an article, peer research article, Craig Harper, Mark Turner, Bronson Strickland, some of the authors of that. And I sent that over to you, a friend of mine who's a biologist. We had read it together and we had talked a little bit, and he's like, I wonder what John Kemp would say about this. And I said, well, I'll shoot it his way and get his take. But let me just kind of give the synopsis of what kind of transpired. So I think this is a multi-year activity where these deer biologists went out and they collected plant tissue. Either they collected or they had individuals collect in many different states, I think New York, Pennsylvania, Texas, all across the country. So there's 40 species that they identified that are eaten by deer at high rates. They looked at the locations of those particular areas based on soil productivity, and they categorized them. Their ultimate goal was making a determination if the soil productivity index, they compared that against the plants that they retrieved and made a determination if the nutrient content in those plants was of greater significance. And they looked at some different aspects, crude protein, phosphorus, potassium, calcium, some of those that are more critical for, I guess, body mass, fitness, productivity, antler growth, you know, the typical characteristics people focus in on. And they had some conclusions. And one of those conclusions are young plants typically have more crude protein. That was one of the takeaways, as well as phosphorus. Older plants have higher value of calcium. These are not unknown topics. This has been, I think, published previously in other articles from what I can recall. But again, I think this is important. But what they did said it, and I'm not sure this is actually true across the United States or not, but soil's productivity index is not a good predictor of deer forage quality. Their hypothesis has been that nutrient content for a given plant would be similar in a mineral poor and a mineral rich soil. The concentrations in the soil had little influence on the plant. I found that really hard to believe, since everything we talked about today and everything I've heard from you. And we focus on really kind of just those macro nutrients. And, you know, the digestive tract of deer is quite complicated, how they process cellulose, lignified plants, etc. And the microbial communities within their gut, this mutualism that occurs, is really critical to that. And so thinking about more that the animal itself is much more complex than just those elements, crude protein being an important aspect of development, particularly lactation. But I just wanted to send this over to you, John, to take a look and say, you know, I'm not an expert in your field, but I think there's something missing in here. And I don't know exactly what it is, but I have an idea what you might say. So I want you to talk a little bit without being critical.
All right, I'm not going to let you off the hook on that one so easily. What do you think it is that I might say?
I think that you're going to say that they looked at this too simplistically. And maybe there's some controls here that they didn't have in place. I mean, we talked quickly about the analysis that you do on nutrients with your SAP analysis. So the depth and degree of sophistication, their complexities in looking at this may be a little bit off base. Although some of it's absolutely, I think, is probably accurate in some sense, at least at a high level. So I want you to kind of approach it in your mindset.
Yeah, well, I'm delighted. I'm delighted by the framework of thinking and the thought that went into the design of the research project. Yes. So perhaps to offer some context, my passion project or my hobby is beekeeping. I have about 100 colonies. And of course, I can't avoid but apply my professional interest to what is happening in the beekeeping world. And in the beekeeping world, starting back in the 90s, there was the introduction of a new pest called the varroa mite. And the varroa mite has been more than a little problematic. It's caused major pain for beekeepers across all of North America. And to give you some context, this mite, like if you were to have an analog of the mite's body size to a honeybee's body size, and you transfer that to a human, if our body were the size of a honeybee, a mite on our body would be the size of the palm of our hand. So imagine a tick the size of the palm of your hand that vectors diseases and that vectors viruses, just like ticks vector Lyme disease. That's what honeybees are dealing with. They've had no historical exposure to this pest. It got imported from Asia. And so honeybees are in trouble. Now there are beekeepers across the country who are trying to figure out how to breed resistance through a variety of known and unknown mechanisms for resistance to this mite. And some beekeepers have been successful to a degree where they succeeded in breeding resistance to the mite in a certain region,
But when other beekeepers took those resistant bees and moved them to their location, they lost their resistance mechanisms. So it's become apparent that for anyone who's really paying attention, it's become apparent that the resistance mechanisms, yes, there is a genetic component, obviously, but there's also something about the ecosystem that in some environmental contexts, in some ecoregions, the honeybees have, there's something in that environment that allows them to become more resistant to the viruses that the mites vector and also to the mites themselves. And lo and behold, as time goes on, we uncover new needles in the haystack, new clues. We now understand that there is a component of lithium, that when there is enough lithium in the diet, and we're talking parts per billion concentrations, well, there's enough lithium in the diet, the bees become more resistant to mites. And so I've been fascinated by this whole intersection of geology, what's going on in different soil geological types in different ecoregions, what are the types of different plant species, and what does that mean for the minerals that they are absorbing, the minerals that are present in pollen and in nectar, because we're not talking about crude elements such as proteins and amino acids and fats and so forth. We're talking about trace mineral and ultra trace minerals such as lithium that are present in tiny, tiny amounts that are different in different geological contexts that make a difference for honeybee resistance. So I've been studying this and I've been fascinated by this entire topic for years. So this approach of looking at antler development and deer morphology and body development based on a geological context, I think is spot on. I think the idea is absolutely correct.
Yes.
But I think what got missed is, and what is missing is a deeper understanding of some of how these nutrients interact with each other and what that means for plant development and what that means for body development in deer. So I'll just give you a couple of examples. One is when we look at let me organize my thoughts a little bit here. There's a number of pieces that came out of this paper. The idea that plants have fairly similar mineral profiles regardless of the soil mineral profile is not a surprise to me at all. The idea that, let's say, a blackberry bramble cane or blackberry leaves have a similar mineral profile in very different soils is exactly what I would have expected to find as long as you are only measuring calcium and phosphorus and potassium and nitrogen. If you're just measuring macronutrients, that's exactly what you're going to find. And furthermore, you will find they actually mentioned this, I think it's the end of page 13, the beginning of page 14 of the report. There were a couple of sentences that said something to the effect of there are abundant levels of calcium and phosphorus and potassium in these plants ubiquitously. These elements are not going to be limiting factors for deer on even the most poor soils. And I think there's the clue that perhaps got missed, that it's actually not these macronutrients that are the limitation. It's not calcium levels per se in forages or in browse that is going to limit the morphological development or the antler development of a deer. It's not those elements. Instead, it is I would expect, based on the experience that I have with dairy nutrition and with looking at how nutritional levels, there's actually quite a bit of historical research on how nutritional levels develop morphology in people. Following the Second World War, William Albrecht did an extensive analysis of the fitness for military duty from the draft of different soil types all across the Midwest.
Oh yeah, I saw this before, yep.
Yeah, fascinating information where the percentage of dental caries, dental cavities, and the degree of flat-footedness was related to soil geology. So there is without question a geological component to skeletal strength and structure and overall performance. And so I think what got missed is the idea has merit, the foundational idea has merit, but one is two foundational things that I got missed. One is I don't think you can measure or that you can index easily a soil's nutritional integrity based on its productivity, because productivity is largely a reflection of soil tilth and organic matter, not a reflection of mineral content. And I think as I understand it, skeletal morphology is going to be a reflection of mineral content, particularly not of calcium and phosphorus and potassium and nitrogen. Those are the macro components, but what guides those macro components is the trace minerals. So for example, earlier in our conversation, I mentioned calcium and boron. It is common in humans, if ladies are dealing with, they're concerned about osteoporosis, it's common to, has been common historically to supplement with calcium. Well, we now understand that calcium supplementation is largely a waste of time and energy, that it's not a reflection of the calcium that is in the diet or the calcium that is being consumed so much as it is a reflection of boron levels and vitamin D3 and magnesium and strontium that guide where the calcium goes. I mean, we now know that it's possible to have both osteoporosis and calcium deposits in the same person because of a lack or an abundance of calcium, but because these other elements are not functioning or are not present. So I actually believe that if instead of looking at a productivity index, if you looked at a soil geological profile and evaluated the trace mineral content of that profile in a certain region and looked at, okay, what are the boron levels? What are the calcium to magnesium ratios? You would be able to develop a relatively accurate index of body morphology based on some of those characteristics. So I think the idea is an awesome one.
Yes.
We just probably need to look at more details.
Yeah, and I think they'll listen to this. I can reach out to them so they just, you know, again, understand maybe your perspective. And maybe that's a part two. There's no certainty if they're going to continue to do this or not, and they may. So I think it's a good perspective. John, I appreciate all the time that you gave me today. It's a big deal getting you on this podcast. And I think a lot of people, you know, would appreciate your services. I know you do a lot of big cropping, of course, large farms, but some of the products that you have on your website, you know, they're pretty inexpensive. I think folks will realize that. And there's a lot of value. We mentioned some of those earlier, but your knowledge and depth is astounding. You're tied in with all the right people. And, you know, I commend you for your experience, and I think you're going to be a resource for the nation. And I think that's an important thing that I think people need to realize, hopefully in the future here. So I just appreciate you taking time out of your day for me.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having me on. We're all here to play a role, all here to serve each other and to the best of our ability to do that. So I really love and enjoy our work, and I have the privilege of working with an amazing team and amazing people every day. So I have a lot of fun.
Yeah.
That's the important part.
That is. All right, John. Well, we'll talk again soon, and I'll see you. Thanks.
All right. Thank you much.
Bye.
Maximize Your Hunt is a production of Whitetail Landscapes. For more information on how John Teeter and his team of experts can help you maximize your hunt, check out whitetaillandscapes.com.
My day kicks off with a refreshing Celsius energy drink, then straight to the gym. Pre-K pickup, back home to meal prep. Time for my fire station shift. One more Celsius, gotta keep the lights on. When the 3-alarm hits, I'm ready. Celsius. Live. Fit. Go. Grab a cold, refreshing Celsius at your local retailer or locate now at Celsius.com.
From athletic stuff like a full court pickup game, swish, to athletic-ish stuff like a half mile stroll. Get those steps in. Head to Sierra or Sierra.com for the brands you want at the prices that let you do it all. From athletic to athletic-ish, Sierra's got it.
The new Chicken Bacon Ranch Street Chalupa is a Taco Bell. You can't get just one. Okay, so that's not like some marketing hyperbole. You literally can't get just one. They come in twos. So like, if you want just one, you're going to need to find a friend who loves slow-roasted chicken, bacon, and avocado ranch sauce. Or a friend of a friend, or have an awkward conversation with a complete stranger to see if they're obsessed with chicken, bacon, and avocado ranch. Or you could just like eat them both because you're obsessed with slow-roasted chicken, bacon. Okay, you get the idea. The new Chicken Bacon Ranch Street Chalupa is a Taco Bell. At participating Taco Bell U.S. locations for limited time while supplies last.
You saw the game-winning play once, but have to replay it three times on the way back to the hotel. Because some moments don't end at the buzzer. Life's a trip. Make the most of it at Best Western. Book direct and save at bestwestern.com.
This episode is brought to you by Peloton. Break through the busiest time of year with the brand new Peloton Cross Training Tread Plus. Powered by Peloton IQ. With real-time guidance and endless ways to move, you can personalize your workouts and train with confidence, helping you reach your goals in less time. Let yourself run, lift, sculpt, push, and go. Explore the new Peloton Cross Training Tread Plus at onepeloton.com.
President's Day savings are happening now at the Home Depot with up to 40% off select appliances. Looking to upgrade your fridge? Check out LG's newest model, serving up ice in all kinds of styles. Cube, crushed, craft ice, and now new mini craft ice straight from the dispenser. From cold brew to fizzy favorites, these refrigerators will have you entertaining like a pro. Shop President's Day savings and get up to 40% off, plus free delivery on select appliances like LG at the Home Depot. Free delivery on appliance purchases of $1,498 or more. Offer valid February 5th through the 25th, U.S. only. See store online for details.
What is natural? When you read natural flavors on a label, most people don't realize it's often not real food at all. Those hidden ingredients quietly work against how your body feels and functions over time. That's why Just Ingredients uses only real food ingredients, so you know exactly what you're putting in your body. Stop guessing. Start knowing at justingredients.us.
Starting a business can seem like a daunting task, unless you have a partner like Shopify. They have the tools you need to start and grow your business. From designing a website to marketing to selling and beyond, Shopify can help with everything you need. There's a reason millions of companies like Mattel, Heinz, and Allbirds continue to trust and use them. With Shopify on your side, turn your big business idea into... Sign up for your $1 per month trial at shopify.com/special offer.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.